All right, and we've got one final case for argument today. Please take your time and get settled. I will go through the normal instructions as you're doing so. You both generally know them anyways. You'll both have 15 minutes for your primary argument, and then counsel for appellant, you'll have 5 minutes for your rebuttal, should you choose to use it. The podium will adjust, so there's two buttons kind of in the center of the podium underneath that you can raise it or lower it for your height. And with that, I'll ask the marshal to call the next case.
Case A23-1544, Christopher Tigpen versus Best Home Care LLC and Department of Employment and Economic Development.
All right, and counsel for appellant, you may go ahead and get yourself ready at the podium. Please make sure you state your name for the record before you begin.
Thank you, and may it please the court, counsel. My name is Russell Squire. I'm an attorney from Southern Minnesota Regional Legal Services, representing the relator, Mr. Christopher Tigpen. In March of 2020, Christopher Tigpen was 21 years old. The COVID-19 pandemic was just beginning to upend everyone's lives. Because of the pandemic, Mr. Tigpen separated from his job at Target and was applying for unemployment benefits for the first time in his life. At the same time, he was also working as a personal care assistant for his disabled mother. Now, when he went to apply for unemployment benefits, he noted that he was working as a personal care assistant for his mother, that job was continuing. However, when he requested his weekly benefits, he believed that the questions were asking about earnings and work were about whether or not he was returning to his job at Target. And because of this, and he answered those questions based on that belief. Because Deed was expecting him to report his weekly earnings as a PCA, his unemployment benefits weren't calculated correctly, and he was overpaid. And
you're not disputing he was overpaid.
No.
I mean, that clearly
nope.
A mistake was made. He's young. It's first time. Everybody's in confusion. But a mistake was made.
Absolutely. Correct. Yeah, he reported his wages correctly. He's overpaid at least $24,000. In standard unemployment benefits.
And just so we're clear, you're not disputing the amount of the overpayment either?
Nope.
Okay.
Nope. The only potential dispute would be that the federal pandemic benefits have a provision in there that allows them to be waived. So were you to rule in Mr. Thigpen's favor, we would ask that portion be remanded because they were denied based on the presumption that Mr. Thigpen had committed fraud. So if this panel finds differently, we'd ask that they reconsider their decision on whether or not those benefits should be waived. But Deed also found that Mr. Tigpen committed what's called unemployment misrepresentation, meaning that he lacked a good faith belief that the information he was reporting was correct. And this is the determination that Mr. Thigpen's appealing. At hearing, Mr. Tigpen testified that to his good faith belief about that he was reporting correctly. However, despite a lack of evidence suggesting otherwise, Deed upheld the misrepresentation determination. And this determination has severe consequences for Mr. Tigpen. It carries with it a 40% monetary penalty, 1% monthly interest, and a total bar on eligibility for unemployment until the entire balance is repaid. Because of this, Mr. Tigpen owes Deed at this moment approximately $55,447, along with monthly interest payments around $336. However, this decision carries significant errors of both fact and law, and we request that it be reversed. The decision was not supported by substantial evidence. Deed should have been required to carry the burden of proof to show that misrepresentation occurred. The determination was considered as to the preponderance of the evidence standard instead of the proper, clear, and convincing standard for decisions required for decisions of this magnitude. And the severity of the
that may be true, but the statute does say the preponderance of the evidence standard applies in unemployment compensation cases. So how do we get to where you want us to be?
Yeah, so there's a couple different things. So obviously, that's the main statutory rule, but it's modified in a couple ways. First, you know, statutory rules have to comply with procedural due process. So following a Matthews analysis, the severity of, because the private interest is so strong here and the risk of erroneous deprivation is so high in an administrative proceeding, you know, against the agency that is accusing you of misrepresentation, a higher burden needs to be used. And it's a relatively small burden on the agency.
Should that not be a decision that perhaps our branch across the street should address rather than this court? I mean, how can we say that this is not appropriate when we have a statute that guides us?
Yeah, well, because that's why, you know, procedural due process exists. The legislature has their authority to create laws, but they still have to fall within the ambit of procedural due process. So it's up to, so this court, this panel, your job is to make sure they don't go too far. Obviously, the legislature has a wide range of discretion. I'm not disputing that. But there are limits to it, and they're set by the state and federal constitution, and making these decisions according to the preponderance of the evidence violates that.
Do you have a case from Minnesota that applies the standard that you're asking us to apply today?
I don't think there's been a case of a statutory preponderance that was but reversed. Obviously, we have the Christie versus State of Christie case, which is a contract law case from 2016. And that's where the court, you know, not even a constitutional case, sort of a just looking at the legal issues and the weight of the decision that needed to be made, the Minnesota Supreme Court decided that because of the risk of fraud, oral contracts for sale need to be proved by clear and convincing evidence.
And that's a Supreme Court case, right?
Yes.
And that's sort of my point, is that if we don't have a case right on point as an error-correcting court, we can't really create that new law. So that would be something for the Supreme Court to do.
Sure. But substantial evidence is certainly something this court can do. And this decision is not supported by substantial evidence. First, the ULJ relied on the wrong intent standard. And this is something that, you know, even...
Okay, back up.
Yep.
You're arguing, we're talking about substantial evidence now. Your guy testified, and it was determined that his testimony was not credible.
Sure.
All right, so we can't substitute our decision. What do we do with that?
So it's a decision still has to be supported by substantial evidence, regardless of whether or not
it's
credible.
So you're saying that even though the tribunal said not credible, that there was, that the facts belie that, and that finding is erroneous?
Yes. Yes. You know, a decision still has to be supported by substantial evidence. I mean, frankly, in essentially every misrepresentation case that is found, the tribunal is going to find that the person was not credible in their testimony.
We try to tell them, make a credibility determination so that we have something that we deal with.
Yeah. So when that happens, that, you know, if that means that these decisions are essentially being put beyond the ambit of judicial review. If you make a mistake when you're reporting, you go to the tribunal, and if all that they need to do is decide we believe you or we don't, and then that's all the evidence we need to find you of misrepresentation, now we can't. There's nothing to judicially review, because obviously that credibility determination is not going to be disturbed absent some sort of extraordinary circumstances. That's why you need to examine, you know, substantial evidence is a whole evidence in the record standard. And when you look at all the evidence in the record here, it doesn't support the determination. And for instance, you can look at the judge's decision itself, which includes contradictory findings. For instance, the judge says that, you know, Mr. Thigpen made assumptions about how the unemployment system worked and answered the questions based on his assumptions. That itself is a good faith error. And that's why I think this court should review the decision and reverse, because there's findings in the decision that support the conclusion that Mr. Thigpen made a good faith error in judgment, but for reasons that aren't clear, it didn't come to that conclusion. So, you know, it talks about, you know, he made a good faith error. He didn't understand. He was thinking about the way he thought benefits might work during the pandemic. And sure, he made a mistake, and that's why there's a good faith error standard. You know, as we've talked about, if you make a mistake, you get overpaid. It's not like you get away scot-free.
Or he could have been working the system and trying to line his pockets. I mean, it goes the other way, too.
Sure, of course. But in that case, he, of course, reported this job right when he applied for the first time. So given all that evidence, there needs to be something more supporting the idea that he was committing misrepresentation than just really what we have here, the fact that he made an error, again, no dispute there, and the credibility determination of the judge. And based on that, the department is imposing severe penalties on Mr. Thigpen.
Right, I want to talk about penalties, if you don't mind. I'm really intrigued by your argument on excessive fines, this 40% amount and where this comes from. Can you expand on that or shine further light on that?
Yeah, so obviously, so unemployment is sort of a hybrid system where there's sort of federal rules that have to get complied with, and then states get to do what they want. And if you reviewed that report from the Department of Labor, there's wide variety in how states do this. The federal government sets a floor of a 15% penalty for fraud findings, and states are free to modify that. And I think
is there the authority, this 40% penalty, much like in the criminal areas, is there any authority to modify that 40% amount? Is that just, that's it?
Nope. Yeah, it's a absolutely flat, no discretion whatsoever in that 40% penalty. And I think what's unique about Minnesota is the way these penalties combine together. So Minnesota has this unique system of, if you're ineligible for unemployment, if you have a misrepresentation overpayment, you're totally ineligible for unemployment benefits. Most other states, the vast majority of states, say you're eligible, we recoup at 100%. While it may not seem like there's a big difference, if you have a misrepresentation overpayment, that's the difference between maybe getting this, you know, taken care of and back to normal and never being able to get out from under it. And when you add in a 1% monthly interest rate, which is quite high, you know, we're sort of on a treadmill that Mr. Thigpen would never be able to get off of. So I think when you think about why these are excessive, it's not just the 40% fine, and it's not each of these things individually. It's the way they combine together to make it so difficult for Mr. Thigpen or anybody to get off of it. And, you know, another thing, I would like to sort of, turning back to substantial evidence.
Before you do that, I just had a factual question.
Yeah.
Is the 40% fine based on just the $24,000, or is it based on the total amount?
I believe it's based on the total, based on, you know.
So it's based on the total award of $39,000?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
You know, the decision finds that federal pandemic, so you apply the state penalty to federal pandemic payments, but not the interest rate. So the interest rate applies to 40% of $24,000, so about $33,000.
It's an interesting scheme because it's not even as if you can have it reduced to a judgment and then get on with your life or discharge it in bankruptcy, and it's not as if you can ask for forgiveness or even in the criminal world, you can do some sentence to service work and pay it off. It's an interesting creature.
Yes.
But what authority do we have to say that it's putative?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, under the state and federal constitutions, you know, you can just follow enforce the excessive fines clause, you know. You have the right to enforce constitutional violations here, and you should do that. Another point I wanted to make about the substantial evidence issue is, so the judge sort of gets off on a tangent where there's lots of stuff in there about whether or not Mr. Thigpen's beliefs were reasonable. And one of the things that the deed pointed out in their brief is that, you know, so this is on the top, you know, when you get your weekly benefit report, on the top of every page it says, the information you provide will be verified through electronic matching with your information provided by your employers. Failure to provide accurate information may result in a delay of overpayment benefits. So that's at issue ID 486-81520, Exhibit 4, page 13. So, and I think this is important because if you look at the decision, one of the things that the judge says is, well, if he doesn't report weekly benefits, how's the department supposed to know how he's getting paid? Well, every time he fills out this form, the department is telling him, we're electronically verifying your report. You know, there's not, you know, this isn't the only way we're going to get this information. Your employer is going to tell us. So this is an area that's rife for mistake and really easy to understand how somebody, again, this is during the pandemic, very first time ever applying for unemployment benefits, factors that weren't considered in the decision and should have been, and this court should reverse because they weren't, based on the substantial evidence, based on the record as a whole. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, and you'll have 5 minutes for your rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, when you're ready.
Okay, good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Carrie Phillips. I represent Respondent Department of Employment and Economic Development. So in this matter, Relator reported to Deed on 104 separate occasions that he did not perform any kind of work in that particular week when he was working and earning money in order to get unemployment benefits. So Deed investigated this. It issued some determinations of ineligibility. Relator appealed. And then a ULJ held multiple hearings, two different hearings, and made a detailed credibility determination, finding that the relator knowingly lied when he reported that he was not working in each of those weeks. And the record supports the ULJ's credibility determination. So relator testified that if someone had asked him at the time, are you working? He would have said, yes, I used to have two jobs, and now I have one. You know, relator knew he was working at the time. So when the ULJ kind of further probed and asked, you know, why did you answer the question this way? Relator testified that he assumed the question was asking, did you work at Target? Relator admitted that the question did not mention Target. Relator tried to explain that he had this assumption because he reported his part-time work when he applied for unemployment benefits back in 2020. But like the ULJ reasoned in that credibility determination, this testimony does not make sense because Deed would have no way of knowing how many hours he worked, what his earnings were for any given week. And moreover, it doesn't show that Relator had a good faith belief that his statement was correct when he answered no each week. He knew he was working and he answered no. And so it may be that Relator believed, based on an assumption about the program, that he should be eligible for unemployment benefits. And applicants have made that argument to this court before. And in a non-precedential decision, Harmon, the court said a good faith belief that he was entitled to unemployment benefits is not the same thing as a good faith belief as to the correctness of his statements in those requests. So he still had that duty to answer that very clear, plain question correctly. I'll kind of move on to the standard of proof argument. So the Minnesota Supreme Court has stated that the legislature has the power to determine the standard of proof in a statutorily created action. So this is a statutorily created action. This is all set forth in Chapter 268. And the legislature determined that all issues in Chapter 268 are determined by a preponderance of the evidence. So the case law that Relator relies on involve matters where a district court is determining a burden of proof based on case law or inferences about legislative intent. So Relator doesn't have a case where a court held that a statutory burden of proof is unconstitutional. So he just doesn't meet that high bar that's required for this court to say that the statute is unconstitutional for burden of proof.
In the context of deed matters, unemployment compensation matters, is there any value for this court to issue some guidance, a precedential opinion that would establish what the burden of proof would be? I mean, I understand your argument, but would that be a value to practitioners?
Well, it is in the statute. You know, I guess it would be a value
to... I guess what I'm saying is to specifically apply it to unemployment cases.
Yeah, well, the statute does apply to 268, which is all, but I mean, of course, it's helpful to have that stated in a case for practitioners to see that doing case law research. It's located in maybe a part of the statute that a practitioner may not be looking at. I believe it's 268.13, so it's maybe a little separate from some provisions. So having a case state the burden of proof, I think, would always be helpful to have that to clarify. It is in the statute, though, that all issues under 268, and whether an applicant committed misrepresentation is certainly an issue under 268. So that squarely applies there.
Are there cases in Minnesota that say the burden of proof meets due process?
I did not. Well, in Alpine Air, they do address a due process argument. I don't believe it's procedural due process, but Alpine Air does analyze whether the consumer fraud statutes, whether the burden of proof there comports with due process. In this matter, you know, Relator argued that the burden of proof kind of converted into a different one because the case is quasi-criminal. So a little slightly different. I mean, I know he also argues procedural due process, but I understood the argument as far as Alpine Air to be that this is a quasi-criminal case. And I would just point out that, you know, in determining whether a case is civil or criminal, courts look to the intent of the legislature and the purpose of the penalty. And here, you know, even, you know, aside from that statute saying what the burden of proof is, the legislature has indicated that this is a civil action. There is a separate criminal section in 268 where applicants can be charged criminally for fraud. The definition is a little different. It requires an intentional false statement or representation. That's not at issue here. The relator has not been criminally charged, and deed cannot criminally charge anybody. You know, that would be referred to a prosecuting authority. But it shows that the legislature intended
why
to be.
Why wasn't this referred then?
Well, I can't speak to that. I'm not sure why it wasn't referred.
I remember a long time ago being a prosecutor and getting those cases fairly regularly.
You did? Mm. Okay.
It's a long time ago.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very long time ago.
Yeah. So it kind of goes out of our purview once it hits that level because we don't do those prosecutions, but it does happen, and it's a separate provision. It's a separate mens rea. It says an intentional false statement or representation. Here, under state law, you know, the standard is making a statement without a good faith belief as to the correctness of the statement. That's the state law. We have the PEUC law, which is a little bit different than that, a knowing statement, knowingly false statement. And so here the judge's decision does cover kind of both of those. But there is a criminal section in the statute, so that shows that the legislature intended this to be a civil action with the preponderance of the evidence standard. And then I'll move to
That's a good segue into my focus on this, the penalty provision, because, I mean, it's significant, 40%, which is kind of akin to the whole criminal analysis and having fines that are have some relationship to where it's at. So I don't have any question. I'm just asking you to address that issue.
Sure. So the excessive fines case law does say that, you know, the excessive fines clause provides kind of a constitutional limit, but in general, courts defer to legislative judgments about fines, penalties. And here the legislature is the one, of course, who set forth this 40% penalty. You know, we argue that this penalty is not grossly disproportional to the gravity of the offense. It is a high penalty, and here it's quite high because the relator received a significant amount of unemployment benefits that he was not entitled to receive. And that was, you know, due because it was during the pandemic, there were these multiple federal programs that he was able to take advantage of. So he was receiving the PEUC extensions, and then he was receiving the FPUC supplemental payments in addition to those. So it is a high overpayment, and then it results in a pretty high penalty as well.
So do you construe this penalty and the amount as somewhat of a deterrent for people not to falsify their records?
That's right. It certainly has a deterrent purpose. You know, DEED uses the misrep language, you know, in the handbook, on the website, saying, you know, you need to accurately report your employment or you can be subject to penalties. So it certainly has a deterrent purpose. And it is called a penalty. So, you know, it does have that purpose as well.
And then I asked Mr. Squire, but I'd like to hear from you. I mean, there's no ability to discharge this at all? You can't say, just let me get on with my life? I mean, tell me what you know of that.
Yeah, well, it does go away in 10 years. So Minnesota statute is a little different
when
you
say go away, is it reduced to
judgment? It's written off.
Written off.
Yes. And so that is a little different than some states.
I didn't know that. Thank you.
Yes, yes. That's in the misrep statute. So some states, if you look at that comparison from the Department of Labor, you know, the percentage of penalties do vary. Eligibility does vary. You know, Minnesota says you can't be eligible if you have a misrep overpayment. But in Minnesota, it does go away after 10 years. In some states, it's a lifetime bar. It doesn't go away. So it can be written off in 10 years.
It can never be reduced to judgment?
Not that I'm aware of. Yeah, not that I'm aware of.
If you referred it and it was prosecuted criminally and it was ordered as restitution, it would be subject to being reduced to judgment, wouldn't it?
Yeah, and I'm not aware of that process for a misrep penalty.
It's a fascinating discussion, and I feel like we're having a conversation on it. But I mean, if this fellow had died, is it taxed against his estate if he's within that 10-year period?
No, I believe the statute covers that as well. If someone
what's
dies,
what's the statute again? I want to revisit that.
Sure.
So if you don't know that, I'll find it.
Yeah, it's 268.18 addresses overpayment. Subdivision 2 is overpayment because of misrepresentation. Let me kind of go through the statute here.
I don't want to take your argument time up. I'm just curious about it more than anything.
Sure. Yeah. There are, you know, methods of recovering overpayments, you know, misrep overpayments that the deed has, and trying to collect those. They're not always collected. Let's see.
So essentially, then you're saying it's not burdensome because there are mechanisms, including a release after 10 years, that this isn't like a life sentence.
Yes, and that's in subdivision 4, paragraph B. If unemployment benefits are overpaid because of misrep, including penalties and interest, are not repaid within 10 years after the date of the determination of the penalty, the commissioner must cancel the overpayment balance and any penalties and interest due, so no administrative or legal proceeding may be used to enforce collection of those amounts. So it does go away after 10 years, but it is high in this instance because of the amount of benefits that relator wrongfully received. So it is proportional to the overpayment and to the gravity of the offense. The case law looks at the seriousness of the offense. And here it is a significant violation of the law. It was 104 weeks, and it was $24,000 in benefits. And I do want to just touch on Judge Schmidt's question to counsel about whether that overpayment attaches to the FPUC, whether the fraud penalty attaches to the FPUC overpayments. And here, the judge did not impose the fraud penalty on the FPUC overpayments. Perhaps, you know, she should have done that. The law requires her to do that. She didn't assess that onto the FPUC overpayments. It's just on the standard payment, the standard benefits in the PEUC. And that may be because the initial determinations were for the overpayments for the standard and PEUC, and then the MSREP determination attached just to those overpayments. And throughout her proceedings, she just assessed the fraud on the STUI and the PEUC. But I understand that that's not clear when you read the decision. She uses kind of broad language about CARES Act programs. So I understand that that's not clear from reading the decision, but that is what our records show, you know, and I'd be happy to provide relator with.
Well, arguably the fine should be larger.
Yes, yes. She should have applied the fraud penalty to the FPUC supplemental overpayments, but she did not do that. And
you don't want us to send it back.
No, DITA's not going to, is not seeking to do that at all. So that's not part of our case, but I just wanted to clarify that that's how the decision was implemented in our system. Okay, well, I see that my time is about up. If there are no questions, I'll move to conclude. In conclusion, the record supports the ULJ's credibility determination that the relator knowingly misstated his earnings and hours each week. Deed respectfully requests that the court affirm the ULJ's decisions. Thank you.
Thank you. And counsel, you have 5 minutes for a rebuttal.
Yes, thank you. Let's go back here to, you know, that there's this colloquy between the judge and Mr. Thigpen about, well, if somebody came up and asked you if you were working, you'd tell them that you're working, right? He was like, well, yeah, of course, because, you know, he was. But the issue isn't here that, you know, somebody came up to him and asked him if he was working. It's how did you fill out this government paperwork that you were required to fill out, and did you understand it correctly or not? So instead of just thinking about, well, he would tell a friend that he was working, so he should have known, that's, again, not the standard. The statute is clear. It says good faith belief. It doesn't say reasonable belief. It's a subjective standard that the judge in her decision treats as objective. And that is an error that should cause the decision to be reversed. You know, over and over again, you know, you hear like, you know, how was Deed to know how, you know, what his earnings were? Why is that something that an applicant for government benefits needs to consider in order to do it correctly? You know, this is a difficult system for people to navigate, and the system and the people administering the system should understand that. He read the benefits, he did his best, and if you do it wrong, there's consequences. It's an overpayment. You have to pay a significant amount of benefits back. But in order for it to be a misrepresentation, they add a mens rea. They add this scienter requirement. And when they do that, you need to prove it. You don't just say, it's not just a show up and, you know, I don't believe you, so 40% penalty, misrepresentation, overpayment. You have to look through the whole record, look at all of the facts. You know, one of the cases that Deed highlighted in their briefing was that this Cass case, where they said, look, you know, the judge found that the person wasn't, Cass wasn't credible, so, and that's why they found he had a misrepresentation overpayment. Well, the judge also found that Cass was familiar with the unemployment system, so it didn't make sense that he would misunderstand this because he'd done it correctly before. That's not the case here again. This is the first time in the pandemic when, you know, news reports everywhere, you know, there's changes in UI. Everything was changing very rapidly, you know, and, you know, this, you can say he made this mistake 140 times because he did, but I don't, you know, he wasn't getting any feedback that he was doing anything wrong. So if he reported it incorrectly once, of course he's going to report it incorrectly every time, you know, and it, sure, it, took so long, you know, the number is so big because he was overpaid so much, but also because it took the department more than 2 years to figure out that, you know, he was still working at this job that he told them he was working at when he applied for unemployment. And if you, when you read the decision, you know, it's, we're not just looking at the evidence, but the judge's rationale has to hang together. And it just doesn't. When we really get down to the nuts and bolts of why was he overpaid, it's, you know, we just get into this rational belief stuff. You know, I think that's something that you can say is probative of, you know, somebody's subjective intent, right? But it's not dispositive. There needs to be something else in this case to support the determination that Mr. Thigpen, you know, intended to deceive. And, you know, I'd urge you to, you know, look at that Bear case. It's, you know, very clear that in Minnesota we're talking about good faith is subjective. You know, I don't think, you know, a tossed off sort of good faith definition in an unpublished case should carry the same sort of weight as, you know, a Supreme Court decision about how we're going to, you know, interpret the exact same sort of statutory language. And another thing, you know, sort of turning again to this standard of proof, burden of proof, one of the things I'd note is that this isn't a statutorily created cause of action. That's what the court is talking about in Alpine Appeals, because they created a cause of action where you could sue people about consumer fraud. This is an administrative procedure that attaches significant rights to the people who are going through it. You know, it's, you know, you're going against the government who is trying to impose penalties on you. There's significant constitutional protections in that area. And when you talk about, when we talk about quasi-criminal, tell you to look at the Kennedy factors again. Is there an affirmative disability? There is. Does it require a scienter finding? Yes. Is there retribution and deterrence? Yes. And is there an alternative purpose? And the answer is no, because they already have the overpayment collection that they want. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you for both counsel for your arguments today and your briefs. They're helpful. And the matter is submitted. We will get an opinion out in the statutory time frame. And that concludes our oral calendar for today. So thank you, and we are adjourned for now.
All rise.